What I want to talk about in the hour that we're together is what does it mean to what are some of the qualities that are going to be needed to lead this kind of change, to think about what it means to lead a church into uncharted territory. And I know that for your congregation, this is an exciting season, the celebrating the end of the 50th, having a capital campaign, having an event every single week of the fall is what it seems like. There's a lot of activity going on. So it shows the vibrancy that you have in your midst. And so I'm just privileged to be part of it. So let me do a couple things. Just the key big ideas from the time together is basically this. We were trained for a different context. That's obviously the part that I talk about. And most of the time when I'm talking, when I talk about training, I'm talking to pastors. But it's also very true for elders and deacons and others in church ministry. There is a kind of a culture of training that really does revolve around kind of what I would call a Christendom context that is different. The fading of Christendom requires us to learn to lead all over again. That in the same way that we have to learn to be disciples when without a Christendom advantage, that we have to have the kind of humility of learning. Even the leadership qualities are different and are important for us to think about. And then the third is just to continually remind ourselves that leading in uncharted territory requires learning and it results in loss. And we'll talk more about both of those a bit in the next hour. So what I'd like to do just to engage you in this process, so it's not just listening to me for an hour, is do an exercise briefly with you. Just it'll take about 4 minutes or so, that I got from when I taught high school Bible for 1 year. My daughter was going to a Christian high school. I was transitioning from my pastorate into the seminary. The principal came to me and made a comment about how hoped that now that we're both in theological education together, we could both do some good. And I said something about the fact that at least at Fuller, we didn't have to worry about having a football team that took all the resources away from the Bible department. And so, to which then she asked me what I thought about what I meant by that. I told her that I thought that the school's athletic program was much better than its Bible program. And then she challenged me to do something about it. Next thing I know, I'm teaching high school Bible. So I was commuting once a week. I was commuting back to Orange County to teach a class of high school seniors a Bible survey overview and create a course for them. And what I realized was that most of these Christian kids, all grown up in church, grown up in Christian schools, they knew a lot about the Bible, but they didn't know the Bible. They knew what their youth pastor had said about the Bible, but they hadn't read much of it themselves. So I had them really read a lot of Bible. And so since I had them doing that, I gave them a way to read. And this is and also led to our discussion. So it went like this. I said, if you're reading along and you find something that really inspires you, put an exclamation point just in the margin of the Bible. Go ahead and mark it up. If it's something you want to underline, something you want to tweet, something you want to tattoo on your body, anything that you thought is just really worth holding on to, just put an exclamation point. If you run into something that's completely confusing, you're not quite sure what it is. What's an ooman? What's a thuman? What's the difference between a Sadducee and a Pharisee? What does that mean? What's the big deal about a Samaritan? What's that? Put a question mark. We'll come back to those. If you run into something that bothers you and you're not even sure why, it just kind of sits like a pebble in your shoe, kind of like a sliver in your brain, it just irks you, put the universal sign for cuss words there and next to it. Don't actually cuss, just put the symbol. And then if you find something that actually, when you read it, it makes you stop and go, because you know that it's going to make you have to change something, then put the delta sign, my shout out to math teachers everywhere, the universal sign for change. So the way I put it is inspire, inquire, irk, require. There you go. There's your little four little things. What I would like you all to do, without marking up Bibles or anything, is just think back about the morning, now that you've had a few minutes and you've had some food. Turn to the person next to you and just pick one of these categories, inspire, inquire, irk, require, and just share that with each other. You each get about 2 minutes. And I want you to know that I used to give extra credit for the irks. I always find them to be the most interesting. So in the same way that I always like to nudge the introverts to participate, I also like the irkers, the irked people, to participate. So inspire, inquire, irk, require. If you could just take I'll give you about 4 minutes. So each of you get about 2 minutes to talk, just something from the morning. And if you're one of those people who snuck in, maybe you missed the morning, here's a good chance to catch up. I'm going to give you one more question to talk about together now that you kind of thought about that. And the question I want you to think about now is about the context of your church. And here's what I'd like you to do is you can have this conversation around the whole table if you want for just a few minutes. Here's the question. What is one challenge in the church that you just can't seem to get traction on? What is one thing that keeps coming back over and over again? One thing you find yourself working on or talking about a lot that seems to, no matter how hard you work on it, it keeps coming back. I want you to think about what I really want to do is, as we go through the rest of this hour, I want you to be primed with actually the real specific context of the kind of challenges you guys are facing as a church. So would you spend about 4 or 5 minutes just talking about that around your table? You don't have to give lots of commentary, but at least get them on the table. At least one traction you think is one of the most pressing, recurring issues you're always dealing with. Go right ahead. So here's the reason we're doing those things. One is I want you thinking about the concepts that we talked about in terms of adaptive change. And I also want you thinking about your particular context. I think it's really important as we go through these things, keeping that as present for you. What will also help me is if I could hear a bit of, if you would mind just having a, maybe point to someone at your table to be the representative, just to do a little bit of feedback. We won't catch from every table, but maybe some of you could just volunteer. What are those, how do you think, what are the recurring challenges that you talked about? What are those things that you find yourself facing as a congregation over and over and over again? Could just a couple of volunteers. Go, please. So personally engaged in the mission of the church, getting people to actually personally be engaged in that, right? There's that old 80-20 thing. I think somebody said to me, 80-20 is our goal. We'd like to get to the day where 20% of the people were actually doing 80% of the work, right? So, okay, good. So the personal engagement. Great, please, ma'am. So that's a very important part. So when we talk about issues we can't get traction on, it's always important to recognize, hey, some of these issues have been around for a while, but that's important to pay attention. Yeah, the struggle of we're aware of it, we'd like to have more diversity, we'd like our church to reflect our community, and we struggle with that. Good. Thank you for raising that. Good. Other things that you have a hard time getting traction on. What are the conversations you find yourself having over and over again? And the denomination, this is a relatively new thing. It's only been 40 years in a row, yeah, that we've been, yeah, really. We're on a winning streak. I always tell people, the Presbyterian motto now is, hey, we didn't lose as many people as last year. That's a renewal for us. Yeah, go ahead. So a very common strategy for lots of churches, especially larger churches, was basically like, look, the bigger the buffet, the more people will bring to the table, right? And so you start realizing that after a while, it doesn't feel like a big buffet. It feels like one of those menus where they can't figure out what they do, right? You know, whenever I see any place that says you can get burritos and sushi, I'm thinking, I don't think I want either burritos or sushi from you. And the church feels that way a lot these days because that was a strategy that we captured. Good. Can I get just a couple more, please? Nice. How many times have you ever felt like all of a sudden you heard of somebody who was going through a crisis or in the hospital or something and you realized, oh, nobody knew, or we weren't there, or the church wasn't there, and you realized, wait a minute, we spent all this time on these systems, and you realize that a huge part of it is people don't necessarily take advantage of the systems that we've developed, right? So good. Can I get one more? This is really very rich. Please. Yeah, we're always grappling with those issues that feel, at one level, they feel so cursory, right? Oh, it's just the informality. It's just our formality or our informality. And then we realize, but there's something actually about this that is part of who we are. So we'll talk about more about this later. What is a healthy adaptation of our core DNA? If we're a church that is, I mean, look at your architecture. That architecture, I mean, you guys know this, but I'm the guy from out of town, right? So, you know, I come walking, the very first thing I do is I walk into this place and I feel like, oh my. Like, you know, I just found myself, I'm fascinated by your architecture, right? In ways that just for you, it's just your house. But you know, there ain't a lot of churches that look like this in, you know, anywhere. So, really, right. So that's going to be a definer of who you are for better or worse. So, okay. So here's the place I want you thinking about this during the next few minutes together. So in one sense, the simplest way to think about your task in leadership and the reason why it always leads to disappointment is you're basically always trying to answer this question. You're always trying to distinguish between what needs to be preserved and what needs to change. This is always the rub. This is the distinguishing moment. It's the discernment moment. That at the basic level, you're asking a question in almost every decision you make. Are we hanging on to something that's critical that we have to preserve because if we lose it, we stop being who we are? Or do we need to change it because if we don't change it, we won't get the chance to keep being who we are? This is the ongoing. This is why, for me, the core of leadership is about discernment. It really is a spiritual activity. But it's a spiritual activity that is built around both decision-making that requires a faithfulness of looking back to the past and a hopefulness and a vision about the future. And this is why I think our polity as Presbyterians, which is built around deliberation for discernment, should make us better at this than we are. So this is a chance for us to think about. So for example, here's an example of one church. Notice just by looking at their architecture, we talked about architecture for a moment, notice what they thought was so critical, so very important to their church, that they etched it in stone. So notice this for a second. Think about this. This is so great to talk about this one with Presbyterians. So imagine this, right? This church is over 100 years old. It was a church that Billy Graham at one time called it the leading church in America, right? When they built this church, they had so much money that they were able to build not only a Gothic cathedral, but that they had Tiffany stained glass windows. So this was built with the largest, like strongest, like most not only captains of industry, but a group of people who had style, taste, everything they probably had, resources they had. They built this church. They had a committee that probably decided every single detail, right? So there was probably a committee that got together to decide that plaque. They spent a lot of time, and what they decided was, if you're gonna pay somebody, we're Presbyterians, we don't like paying anything, right? If you're gonna pay somebody to put something that's gonna be over the front door till Jesus comes back, then what we know for sure about our church is that we are the First Presbyterian Church. We don't even have to say where, because we know who we are. And there will be a morning service at 10:45 and an evening service at 7:45. And we don't even have to say which day of the week that is, because we all know what we mean, right? Every time I see this picture, I think this is probably the biggest no-brainer of the world for them, right? Okay, that's what we're going to put, because if somebody shows up, they're going to want to know what time the morning service, what time the evening service is. And the crack up about this, of course, is that I actually know the person who was the pastor of this church in the 1970s. And it was his job to close the evening service. The evening service got closed the way most mainline evening services got disrupted, because of 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. When 60 Minutes became a dominant television show, Sunday night became the television night of America. When people started discovering that the best way to start your week was a family home watching TV, church attendance plummeted, especially in mainline denominations in the East. And so his job, one of the things he had to do, was close the evening service. Today, the pastor of this church says, there's a crack up about this, is that they actually have like about 5 services in 4 different languages on multiple days of the week, right? So here's the question I want you always thinking about whenever you're making decisions. What are they gonna laugh at you about 100 years from now? What are the things that we're so convinced that they are who we are, that we will etch them in stone? When the truth of the matter is, we can look at something like this today and realize, oh my gosh, how short-sighted, right? So this is why this is really critical. The work of leadership is always about trying to distinguish between those things, between distinguishing what needs to be preserved and what needs to change. And what's hard, the hard part about this is not only the determining, but acknowledging that we're gonna have to change. Alan Dushman wrote a book called Change or Die. Nice title, right? What he did is he did a really interesting study. He decided to study this by looking at people who were told by their doctors they need to change or die. And he even made the subset even smaller. He said they were people who were told by their doctors, you need to change today or you're going to die. You need to know that if you have one more cigarette, one more drink, one more drug, one more Twinkie, you could die. Your health is in that dire of straits. And what he wanted to see was the impact of that kind of blunt, deliberate, focused message, urgent message on how people's behaviors. And what he determined is that if you give people that kind of message, that kind of blunt, focused, clear, urgent message, then 90% of them will die. What it says to us is that change, for most of us, is more scary than death. One study put it 5 out of 7, which is, if you do the math, is close enough to 90%. But what you're really recognizing is how resistant we are to change. We're just profoundly resistant. So if you're in a committee and you find yourself, you know, like rolling your eyes or wringing your hands about people who are like, just insist on, and fill in the blank, we all have them, recognize how profoundly difficult it is to change. Change is really hard. And especially when it's something that is as dear to us as our congregations, our lives, our community together, our traditions, our histories, our theology, right? So here's what Duchman did. Here's what's really interesting. By the way, leadership is disappointing your people at a rate you can absorb. I want you to know that the next 10 minutes are the most depressing part of your whole day. It really gets bad here for a moment. I'm just warning you. This is my version of a trigger warning. Here it is. Like, it's going to get really bad. And I want you to know that, but I'm not going to leave you there, okay? So just know that that happens. Here it goes. Alan Duchman basically studied the 10% that did change. What he did was what's called a positive deviant study. Study the people that did change. Don't study the people who, with all of their excuses, study the ones that were successful, and what do you find out about that? Okay, here's the part that's really bad. Here's what doesn't bring change. I call these are a few of my favorite things, right? This doesn't bring change. Fear doesn't bring change. A doctor can tell you that clearly, and you will not change. We saw this all the time. I'm sure many of you had the experience being here that we had being in San Clemente on 9/11. Not only did you have the Pentagon happening in your backyard, we were told that morning, and for us it was early in the morning, 7:45 in the morning, 7 in the morning. We were told Camp Pendleton and the San Onofre Nuclear Generation Station are on our list of, we think, next possible targets. You have to prepare today. I had to get to our preschool, get everybody sent home, get everybody hunkered down, call my staff together, and figure out what are we going to do if they blow up the nuclear generating station. This is a community where every single year we have a siren go off and we have a fire drill that is a radioactive leak drill. It was that heightened. That night, this is before all social media, remember, 2001? That night, we were packed. You guys probably were too. There was probably a prayer. Some of you were there, right? There was a prayer gathering that night. Every church, all you had to do was open the doors and people came flocking in. And my staff's asking me, what are we going to do for a worship service? I said, worship, we are going to gather, we are going to hug, we are going to pray, we are going to sing a hymn that reminds us that God is in charge, and we are going to go home hugging, praying, singing. That's all we're doing, right? Gathered place was packed. People stood up that night and said, the only thing that we believe that could come good out of this is look at this room. Maybe this is the kind of tragedy that America needs to turn back to God. We all prayed that it would be so. And for the next 3 months, our attendance was the high. But on September 11, 2002, 1 year later, George Barna reported that attendance across the country was lower than it had been a year earlier. And many places, people chart the decline of the church that we're seeing today to that moment. When people are fearful, they turn into, they're willing to change, but they also react from change. And that reactivity gets even more resilient. A less dramatic illustration was when I was a kid, I'm 53. So when I was a kid, I was back in the days of film strips. Remember, they used to play like with a cassette recorder, and they had one kid whose job was to turn it. So they would have a little narration, and then it would go bing, and you would turn and show the next picture, and bing. And I remember when they would do these film strips trying to get kids to brush with fluoride toothpaste, because if not, your teeth would rot out. And so they would show pictures of children with their teeth rotting out. You do not want to be like this child. Bing! He can't enjoy an apple. Bing! Do you notice how ugly this looks? Bing! Don't you want a nice bright smile? Bing! What they discovered is you show those film strips to kids, they will brush the heck out of their teeth for 2 days. And then their dental hygiene habits get worse. So fear and the kind of urgency of fear doesn't change people, not long term. You truly cannot scare the hell out of people. They're not going to turn for good news out of bad news, not in a lasting way. The second one that doesn't work is facts. This is what I would say for us Presbyterians. This is what we keep believing, that if every year we publish how bad our numbers are, that will make us change. We're like, are you kidding? We're just really, what we're good at is publishing bad numbers. like we are consistent about our decline, if nothing else, right? So what you realize is facts themselves do not change people. I mean, I always say this, that, you know, every single time I do a seminar like this, I always say, let me give you one fact so that you can at least leave here knowing something you may not know. Do you need to know that if you'd like to lose a few pounds, you need to eat less and exercise more? Stunned, right? Like, everybody's like, is there anybody in the room that doesn't know that fact? Yet does it change the way we eat, right? The fact itself will not change us. So that's depressing. And then the most depressing moment for associate pastors. Force doesn't change people either. If you think that someday I'm in charge, then it will change, right? If once I have power, then we can make it change. You need to know that force doesn't change people long term either. And we see this even right now, right in our country, right? It doesn't matter who's in charge, that we end up in power struggles, not actually changing things. And so partly, fear, facts, and force. This is the most depressing part of the whole thing, right? Because for most of us, these are our strategies. We're either going to be really clear, really blunt, tell people the truth that we need to change. We're going to give them facts, give them numbers, give them stuff. We're going to put people in power who will bring about change. We're going to make it happen. And then we try to figure out why no one's truly changing. It just becomes more and more resistant all the time. Okay, now things get better. I just want you to know that. Because here's what does produce change. This is what Alan Dushman did look. When he looked at the people whose lives did change, the positive deviance, he found this. Fear, facts, and force don't. But what does is, what he says, is relate, repeat, reframe. Relate, repeat, reframe. New communities, relationships make us change. If you have a new community, a new group of people who are important to you, if you find yourself in a new set of relationships with a set of different practices, actually embodying change, taking steps, if you really want your children to have better hygiene, you just get them to floss one tooth. And really, no time, they will develop a habit over time that will lead to that. You need to change new communities of people with new practices that lead to new ways of thinking. Notice the thinking follows the practice, and the practice follows the relationship. So a core of discovery that finds itself functioning in a different way because they're off the map, thinks about the world so differently that they will listen to a Sacagawea. New communities, new practices, new ways of thinking. And it has to be radical. You cannot tweak your way to lasting change. You have to get to the root of the issue that's in the way. You have to get to the core issue and change that one. It becomes critically important to recognize that most of us want to make change that will be non-disruptive. And that's the rub. Now, by radical, I don't mean ruthless. And I don't mean reckless. What I mean is that you have identified the core issue that needs to change, and that needs to change wisely and well. Let me pause for just a second. Any questions about this piece so far? I want to build the rest of my remarks on this. Let me just pause for a second. Yeah. Yeah, it really is. So for example, one of the parts that we've talked about, so I work very closely. One of the centers that works for me is the Fuller Youth Institute. And so one of the big changes that's happened in youth ministry, as our folks have begun to recognize that there is this issue about young adults leaving the church, is they've said, what are the practices that are needed to keep young adults in church? And the answer really comes down to, the very first thing is, they don't need the church to be more cool. They're not interested in whether you have artesian coffee and a person up front with skinny jeans and a tattoo and you call your church the flood. They're not interested. That's not the thing that brings them, right? What they need is the church to be warm. If they can identify relationships of people who know them well, what they used to say is in youth ministry, there used to be, when I started in youth ministry, the rule of thumb was, and I remember being told this, Todd, you have to have one adult for every five kids. Because you need to have proper supervision and proper discipleship and stuff. You had to recruit one adult for every five kids. We now say we actually need five adults for every young person. Because if a young person can identify five people who know them, pray for them, love them, and welcome them, they will stay engaged in the church. Now, this is hard, but if you think about that for a second, that we can do, right? That is a change of organizational culture, but that's a lot better than say, oh, let's build a gym, right? There's churches all over America build gymnasiums, and we got a lot of churches that are holding a lot of extra chairs from when the church used to be bigger, and now that gymnasium is a really nice storage unit, right? So you start recognizing that relationships are hard, but once we focus on relationships, we can begin to think about that differently. So it's not easy, but it is actionable, and I would say it's also part of who we are as a church, right? Okay, so please. Well, part of it is that I think people really, really, I mean, we can spend some more time on this specifically, but one of the ways to think about this is the key to change really starts relationally. If you can just recognize that. So that's why a healthy church is really necessary for a church that can go through change. A church that functions around building relationships and cultivating relationships. Even a leadership team. I always say when I'm consulting, it's with a group maybe this size or half this size who are the leaders of a church. And I always say to them, the most important thing I need you to get is the church is stuck where you're stuck. And that's the good news. If I could do nothing but help you develop a new set of practices with a new way of thinking, and if all you do is stay in relationship to the rest of the congregation will change. If the congregation can develop relationships with each other and stay connected with the community will change. You don't have to change the world. You just have to change the folks sitting right here who've committed together to be the leaders of the church. So thinking about that from that context. One more and I'll keep going. Yeah. They build on each other, but the most important thing actually starts with the relationships. And so if I'll give you the classic example of this is Alcoholics Anonymous. AA meetings are built around you need to get yourself to a meeting where you can get to know other people who are working on being sober. But what we know about AA meetings is that about 50% of the people in an AA meeting are still actively drinking or using. The difference is when they get a sponsor. As soon as you take the step to having someone in relationship that you've had to ask, will you be my sponsor and can I call you, then sobriety goes up. I know some of this because my brother's an alcoholic. And my brother and I had this whole conversation about the fact that, that he literally had to have someone in his life look at him and say, the only thing that you're going to be able to count on is that I'm going to be a person in your life who you can talk to about this. And then the person, the very next thing they had them do was start, the steps are basically a set of practices. And one of the key things they had him do is they said to him, Scott, you need to think about write down on a piece of paper 100 things that will give you joy that you can do without alcohol. Now, you need to know, I'm Italian by background. I drink, our family drinks. We have wine and is like at the center of our entire family. Literally, for my brother, he said, I sat down for 4 hours to write that list. And at the end of 4 hours, I had 4 things. It took me 3 weeks to think of 100 things that would give me joy without alcohol. But before he could think, can change his entire reframe of his life, he had to have some people around him and a set of practices that he could do. Literally stuff like he said, I decided that I would take up drawing because I've always wanted to do art and I never have. And now instead of investing in bourbon, I will invest in pencils. Right? He just needed to have another way of thinking about that, right? So partly what I want you to wrestle with is change is about a practice. It's about a way of being in relationship together that allows you to begin to act differently. That's how culture change happens. That's how organizational change happens. But there is a reframe. And that's why I use the language of adaptive leadership. So when I often say this, if not preaching program or pastoral care, then what? Then practices. So I'll give you one example of one practice out of the life of my family that became really significant in my entire leadership life, and now has become really significant at Fuller, and it came out of 9/11. After the 9/11 event, after we had had just that, remember that night when we're at home, my wife Beth says to me, Todd, I don't know what's going to happen in this world. I do not know what's going to happen with your pastorate. I don't know what we're going to do, but here's one thing I do know. We are going to start doing something this Sunday, and we're going to do it no matter what, and I just need you to agree. We're going to have a family dinner every Sunday night. and here's what we're going to do. You're going to wake up from your nap after preaching. The kids are going to put away their homework, and we are going to make dinner, and we're going to have dessert even when you're on a diet, and we're going to light a candle, and we're going to teach the kids the Lord's Prayer, and we're going to pray it together. And then we added to it what we called high-low, which really is the Ignatian Prayer of Examen. We wanted our kids to know that in a fearful world, they needed to pay attention to where God was present. So what we taught them was the Prayer of Examen, which is basically this. You look back every night, and we did this once a week as a family. You look back at the week and you say, where was God in the middle of the week? And where did I say yes to God in such a way that I could feel his consolation, that I could feel his presence, that I could experience God's presence? In a world that was filled with all this uncertainty and all the media and all of the pain, we wanted our kids to pay attention to that still small voice as much as whatever else they were hearing. And then you ask, so where were you, God, and I said no to you? Where did I instead choose to go after my flesh rather than of the Spirit? Where did I notice the things that would give me love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control? And where did I do the things of the flesh? Where, God, did I find your joy, your consolation? Where did I instead lean into my desolation? And this practice is at the core of Jesuit spirituality, and is at the core of the spirituality that we teach our students now. We teach our students who come to seminary because somebody told somebody, I say everybody who shows up at Fuller Seminary, somebody said to them, you're like the best Christian I know. You should go pro. Yeah. You know, right? You should go to professional Christian school. Go do that. And what we really wanted them to know is if you show up thinking that, you're not going to change. We need you showing up asking, where is God in my life? Where am I being obedient to God? And if I'm confused, how do I go back and use the scriptures to understand if that was God or not? Right? So that practice, that simple little practice, became the center of our family life. Every Sunday night. Home-cooked meal, dessert, candle, Lord's Prayer, high-low. When the kids were little, they didn't understand the consolations and desolations. So we would say to them, so what was your high, what was your low? And my daughter would say, well, my high was when all the kids picked me to play in the game at recess. Great, what was your low? Well, my low was I didn't do very well on my test, so the teacher asked me to stay after class. Okay, good. And this would go on every week. Finally, one year, all of a sudden you hear the kids say something like this. Well, my high was the kids picked me for the game, but it didn't feel like a high because, you know, I started realizing they didn't pick every kid. And I started feeling conflicted and wondering, maybe I don't want to play games with kids who don't pick other kids for games. And the low was that I didn't do well on the test again. But you know, this teacher and I had a really good talk, and she's really nice to me, and she really encouraged me, and she told me that I actually have other smarts. So maybe it's not a, maybe my highs are not, maybe my lows are, and we could say, you know, what you're paying attention to is not the things of the world, but the way that God can use things that we sometimes call bad things for good. And God can use things that we sometimes call good things and reveal that they're not quite so good. And paying attention to what God wants to do is more important than what you want to do. And over time, they discover discernment. And that spiritual practice was at the center of our lives. That's the one we used to help our kids decide which college to go to. That was the practice that we used when we decided it was time for me to leave behind San Clemente Press and say yes to Fuller Seminary. It's the practice to this day. Whenever our kids come home from wherever they are, we ask them to stay over on a Sunday night. We do the exact same thing. We have guests come to our home on a Sunday night. We'll say the Lord's Prayer, which a couple times I've had to say to people, like, so which version do you use? I made the mistake of saying to a girl my daughter was dating, excuse me, debts or trespasses? She was stunned to hear the pastor of the church ask her that question at the beginning of the meal. I was trying to be hospitable. Which way do you say the Lord's Prayer? She took a while to recover. That was a practice, and that practice kept us focused. The question I want you to think of is, during times of change, who are the people that you're going to be committed together about going through change? What are going to be the core practices that enable you to be the kind of community that live out the mission of God? And how will that begin to change your thinking? That thinking is exactly what was at the core. That reframe was at the core of Lewis and Clark. What they got to, what they nailed, was when Meriwether Lewis was sitting at the edge of the Lemhi Pass, he could say, "We proceeded on," because even though the President of the United States told him, "You're to find a water route," what he really wanted to find was everything he possibly could. He was a person of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was about learning and serving humankind. So on his 31st birthday, Meriwether Lewis, in the middle of nowhere, writes in his journal, "I reflected that I had yet done but little, very little indeed, to further the happiness of the human race or to advance the information of the succeeding generation." Notice that's what he cared about. Notice, to further the happiness of the human race or to advance the information of the succeeding generation. Those were his core values. So at a time of crisis, in the middle of this, in the middle of his birthday reflection, that's what he came back to. This is what I'm about. He didn't say, "I reflected on the fact that I'm not quite sure if I'm going to find a water route or if it's going to help the economy of the United States or whether Thomas Jefferson will be proud of me." What he went back to was his core value and resolved in the future to live for mankind as I have heretofore lived for myself, he said at his 31st birthday. At these moments, what you have the opportunity to do that becomes really critical in a time of change, especially as you think about things like your capital campaign and your future, the things God's called you to do, is to keep coming back to and asking, what are those core values? What are those key things that make us who we are that we will preserve? Because we have to preserve those things to know what we need to change. That's what the difference between a technical problem and an adaptive challenge. A technical problem can be solved by an expert. Again, technical doesn't mean trivial, right? A heart bypass is not technical. I don't want an adaptive dentist, right? I don't want somebody experimenting with learning and loss on my teeth. When I fly home tomorrow, I don't want an adaptive pilot. I want technically competent experts. And when you build the buildings, get engineers who are technically competent. But when it comes to changing the culture of a community of people to be able to reach that world that has dramatically changed in the last 50 years, you're going to need to have adaptive capacity. You're going to need to be able to have a community of people who are willing to live into new practices with a new way of thinking. It requires learning. It results in facing loss. And this is, I think, is for most leaders, the most important one to pay attention to. It reveals the gap between your aspirations and your actual values. It reveals the gaps between what you think you should be about and what you're really about. The gap between what we say we believe and what we do. At San Clemente Presbyterian, we had to grapple with the fact that we were deeply committed to being evangelical. We deeply committed to preaching the gospel. We were deeply committed to seeing people come to know faith in Christ. But the number of adult baptisms I did in 17 years, I could probably count on two hands. We were committed to being evangelical. We just weren't as committed to evangelism as we wanted to admit. And that gap was part of our problem. We could call ourselves one thing, and after a while, the very central passion of our church became nothing more than a badge for differentiating ourselves from somebody else in town. Not the fire that wakes us up in the morning and makes us pray for our neighbors or extend ourselves. That your adaptive challenges are in that gap, in learning, loss, and gaps. And that's what has to be radical. You have to get right to the core of your own sense of identity and say, this is the thing that we need to live out. So when I ask you, what's one challenge in your church that you just can't get traction on? My guess is the reason why it keeps coming back is it's one of these kinds of challenges. It will require learning. It will require loss. It will require you to deal with the gap between the aspirations, what we think we should be about and what we're actually about, And it will require you to begin to think differently about the kind of practices that will enable the church to live differently. And especially when you realize that fear, facts, and force won't work. This 80-20 one has been one that's been near and dear to my heart. I had the man I told you about who made 100 phone calls, he grew up in Iowa. And he used to say to me, Todd, the biggest problem that you don't understand, those of us in the Midwest understand, is you're from California. We know that shame and guilt actually accomplish a bunch of stuff. You should just use more shame and guilt. Like, right? If you just would shame and guilt some people, we could get them out to do stuff. And I would you know, push back against him and say, Al, if you're doing this out of shame and guilt, you're fooling me, because you're alive, you're filled with passion, you're good at this. This is your gift mix. If I asked you to do something you didn't want to do, you wouldn't want me shaming and guilting you either, right? What changes people is that you actually let them pay attention to their actual values. When you try to get other people to do stuff because they should do it, you'll always get resistance. And that's the gap. That's what's so hard all the time. How do we create a culture that actually engages people in the mission? Or how do we create a culture that actually allows us to think about what it means to be warm and welcoming in an environment that is going to be more formal? How do we change how do we be the kind of people we need to be to reach our neighbors and to fulfill our mission? How do we make those changes? They're going to have to come through relationships, through new practices of ways of being together, and through a reframing of thinking that we're going to have to learn as we go and deal with losses. That's the difference, technical and adaptive, same kind of thing. So let me say something a little bit about this. Here's some principles just to take home with you as you go. First principle, the key adaptive principle is this. People don't resist change, they resist loss. If you can remember that, what you can pay attention to is you can muster empathy for people who are going through change. It doesn't mean you stop. But when someone is, I was going to say on the patio, I don't know where you guys meet to fellowship, here maybe, right? When someone comes up to you and is mad about a change you're making, remember they probably experience it as loss. I'm losing my church. My friends are threatening to leave. I don't remember myself. We're going through some major changes at Fuller that have been wonderful and absolutely necessary, but are disruptive. One of my professors, who I love, she was one of my professors, now we're colleagues. She looked at me and she said, Todd, where is the Fuller you and I love? I said, the Fuller you and I love needs us to make changes so that a whole world will have the same experience we had. But it means it's not going to be the same. People that don't resist change, they resist loss. Which means you have to get beyond win-win solutions. You have to acknowledge that you will have to have a win-lose solution. It may be 1-1A. It may be 1-2. It may be today this, then that. But people will experience the changes as loss. And if you know that, then all of you who've been trained as Stephen ministers, or all of you who've been trained, who have ever walked with anybody through grief, I said, this is the way the church, we should be the best people in the world. We're the ones who know what to do with human loss. You can't become a pastor without going through CPE. When I was 26, I had a day where I had 3 people die in one day. By the time I was 28, I had buried a child and his mother in the same grave. We know how to walk into a room when people are dealing with the loss of their loved ones, yet we don't know what to do with a church or a culture or a society that is having the exact same grief. And if we could muster that capacity, we could offer to a changing world ways of being able to change. People aren't resisting change, they're resisting loss. Adaptive change is an inherently conservative process. What it means is the change to occur, you have to pay attention to what you preserve. So the first principle is people don't resist change or resist loss. And the second one I'll leave you with is this, which is for change to last, it must be a healthy adaptation of the DNA of the group. The change can't feel as if it's coming from somewhere else. There's an old famous rabbinic tale that when you get to heaven and God wants to speak judgment to you, he will not say, why weren't you more like Moses? He will say, why weren't you more like the you I created you to be? I had a Moses. I needed you to be you. The church isn't going to say, why weren't you more like the flood? It's going to be, why aren't you more like the National Presbyterian Church I needed you to be? The more you're in touch with your core values, the things that make you who you are, and your adaptations are the faithful adaptation of those values, the more the change will be received. Here's a simple way to get to it. I hope sometimes during your capital campaign you'll do this. Just gather a group of people. Know this fact. Once you've determined what will never change, you must then be prepared to change everything else. So the key is getting to what will never change. That's where you spend most of your time, right? Get clear on what's never going to change. And you get there by having people tell stories. So whenever we consult with a group of people, we have them have a meeting like this where we put them around a table, we make them eat some food, and then we tell them, tell us a story about a hero in the church, about a cherished moment, about one that says, you know, if you want to know what we're really about, this is what we're really about, this one. Have them tell a story that is about, this is the moment that I was most proud of us. Or here's the moment when I knew this was my tribe. This is why I'm here, because of this moment. And have people tell that story and have someone in that table who is listening for what those stories mean. So at San Clemente, we had a bunch of those stories. I told you about 9/11, but what I didn't tell you is that 2 weeks after 9/11, I had to hold a congregational meeting where, because we had a plan to do a capital campaign to tear down every building on our campus to the dirt except our sanctuary and then remodel that one. Because we had determined that we wanted to be a multi-generational community. And the layout of our campus was such that all the children, people with children went one way, and all the people without children went another way. Oh, that doesn't happen anywhere else, does that? And you know what was standing right in the middle? Was the original church sanctuary. The place where most of the people in our church had been married, had buried their loved one, or baptized their children until 1980. We had to literally tear down that chapel in order to make us into have the kind of campus we needed. And 2 weeks after 9/11, I had asked a mostly older congregation, said, look, the demographics say younger families are coming. If we want them to come here, if we want to be the community for the community that we say we are, I need you to tear down all the buildings that you all built, and I need you to pay for it.
They loved it, huh?
They voted for it. This is why I love those people. 10 years later, $10 million and $6 million worth of debt later, we were sitting in a brand new campus with a brand new sanctuary, and a man broke into our sanctuary, busted our baptismal font, destroyed our communion table, tore the televisions off the cry room wall, started breaking the pews, tore off all of his clothes, passed out on the chancel, told the police that found him that he had spent the night in there cursing God. Found him in a squad car at 7 a.m. He'd just been back from Afghanistan. He'd watched some tragedies that had hurt him. He was a Marine, and he had vandalized our campus. This congregation that had built this church, we had the session decided that what we would do is that we asked a Marine family to come alongside of him. He acknowledged that he needed a lot of psychological and emotional help. He got the help, he made restitution, and 4 months later, he took communion at the very place that he cursed God. That's what our church was about. It was not about the buildings. It was about seeing that people who did not know the love of God could know the love of God. It was about being willing to tear down our buildings if it got in the way of our fellowship, and about welcoming people into our fellowship who needed to know the love of Christ. That's what we were about. Part of the way we did this is because we used this picture. This picture we blew up to about that size, and we put in our narthex during the building project. This picture was found at the City Hall. And when it was at the City Hall, it had a caption on the bottom that said, "Early Marine Biology Class." Somebody took the picture down, took it, unframed it, peeled off the label, and saw that it said First Sunday School held on the beach in San Clemente. They figured out that it was our church because they recognized that this woman had been a leader in the community who'd gone to our church, and that her granddaughter, Carolyn Garber, was the little girl in the white right in the center who was still a member of our church. We blew this church, this picture up. We put it in the narthex during the building campaign, and we wanted everybody to know that this was our history because this is our core values. What do you notice? There are children and adults both learning together. There's not a building in sight. We were doing a building program that was not about a building, but it was about a group of people who could learn the scriptures together. And there was a Bible in the center. And it was taught by a woman. We're Presbyterians. We believed in women in ministry for over 40 years, but in 1997, we had never had a woman pastor. We put this picture up. We've had four since then. When people get in touch with your core values, this is who we've been from the beginning. We've been about our community. We've been about multi-generational. We've been about the scriptures in the center. And we're about leadership that is gifted for leadership. Things begin to change. People don't resist change. They resist loss. And second, for change to occur, and at last, it has to be a healthy adaptation of your core DNA. Be a community of people who develop practices around those reframes, and you can see what God will do with you. I'm over time, so we should stop.